Good morning and, oh, excuse me, good evening. This is your host, Linda Stansberry. Thank you for joining us on Thursday Night Talk. Today we're going to be talking about allyship. We're talking about how to be good white allies to people of color. The numbers to call in are 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. You can also text TNT, that's 492-KHSU. And I'm joined in the studio tonight by my guest, Erin Powers Taylor of True North. Hey, Erin.
Hi.
Kim Burgell, who's a city council member with the city of Eureka. How you doing, Kim?
Great. I'll be speaking for myself.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And also Meredith Oram of SURGE. And could you explain SURGE's acronym to everybody?
Sure. SURGE Humboldt is showing up for racial justice Humboldt. I'd also just share that we are reexamining our name and considering something that might be more inclusive given recent criticism of our group.
I wasn't aware of that. Is that something we're going to dive into tonight at all?
Hopefully.
All right. Well, SURGE was a group that was suggested to me recently when W. Kamau Bell came to town. I don't know if you guys are familiar with W. Kamau Bell. He has a great show on CNN called United Shades of America, and he's one of the most interesting speakers on this topic, and he also has a great podcast that I'd recommend. So just to start us off a little bit, could you explain a little bit about what SURGE is about and how long it's been here in Humboldt County?
So SURGE Humboldt is in its baby stages here. We've had 4 general meetings so far, and maybe 6 leadership meetings. So there are a group of us that came together thinking, looking on the map where SURGE has chapters. There's this big gap between San Francisco and Eugene. We're like, okay, we need some white people talking about race issues and getting involved and supporting already designed community, established communities of color. So we're pretty new. We're still kind of trying to figure out what our role is exactly. The things we're clear about are that we want our group to be inclusive. We defer to communities of color for direction. And we're also at the same time working on education to support white people in understanding their privilege and the systems of white supremacy that operate, and hopefully undoing that and teaching them and supporting them in that process, and then getting them to talk to other white people and stand up and say something like Kamau was saying we need to do.
Excellent.
We're late in doing it, but we need to do it more.
Absolutely. And I'm going to read a quote that I emailed to all of you guys that really inspired this topic for me. And just broaching really quick the elephant in the room, we are all white people, and we are here tonight. We're talking about our role as white people and being allies to people of color. And I was inspired to have this topic in our show tonight specifically because of something that W. Kamau Bell said when he recently came to HSU. He said, "White people in this country never feel any need or any pressure to denounce, regulate, distance themselves from other white people when those white people act out of pocket. Black people and every other racial, ethnic, religious, sexual minority understand, come get your boy, all too well. Being forced to account for someone else's words or actions is particularly old hat for black people, as is being made to speak on behalf of all the black people as translators or apologists, whether they want to or not." So I think that it's important to talk about that, and I think that it's important to have conversations that we might not necessarily be comfortable with. And one of the things that he also said in his show is that people of color are being called on to defend themselves all the time, and that white people defer to people of color to defend, you know, their position against racism instead of actually standing up and being that defense and taking responsibility for people in our community who we might let get away with outright racism or slights or deferring to white people as the default. And I think that it's really important to have very uncomfortable, cringeworthy conversations in order to get to a place where we can stand up for other people. And maybe, Erin, this is a good opportunity for you to talk about True North a little bit and your work with them.
Okay. True North is True North Organizing Network, and we are part of the PICO. We're a PICO federation. We are people in community, improving communities. The work that we do is a lot is based in the racial issues that go on. Right now, we're actually working on research towards the SB 54. And and we are also we have all different groups. They're called LOCs, local organizing committees, and I'm part of the coastal team. And right now, we're actually working along with our Latino LOC and our Elders Caucus, which is mostly clergy, and our Native American leaders, in working towards finding out how we can protect our immigrant community the best that we can. So that's kind of where we're at in this area right now.
Excellent. And then Kimbergill, as you said, not speaking for the Eureka City Council, but speaking as your role as a leader in the community, what are you seeing as particular issues for your constituency around this? And how do you try to be a good leader and represent people?
Well, you know, we did recently passed a human rights resolution, so we will not be tolerating any kind of hate crime in our city. That's just not something that's going to be okay. And personally, you know, I do support people however I can, and that looks different in lots of different ways. I think that we need to continue to have more and more conversations. This is a beginning. Mm-hmm. This isn't the end, and there's a lot of work that we're going to have to do to bring this forward. And I was reading in the Black Lives Matter, they were talking about how it wasn't so much about this kid getting killed as it was more about, I mean, that was a symptom of the problem, but more than that, it was more about having an even playing field for all of us to be able to be equal. And I am a strong proponent of that. So,
and are you guys generally seeing, are you feeling a lot of tension right now with the recent death of David Josiah Lawson? Are you noticing things about your community that you didn't notice before this happened?
I would say, since we're hoping to, first, that this happened here, I think it's, a devastating loss to, obviously, to Josiah's family and to his community here and to the university. And it, unfortunately, is a devastating act that verifies things that many people of color and students of color have been talking about and how they feel they have not been received by the wider community. In Humboldt HSU and outside of the university campus itself, and so it is devastating that it has come to this degree of mm-hmm. hatred and violence, but I think it requires that we face it, that we humbly listen to people of color, that we believe their stories. So I'm trying to, I think we have to humbly look at what our role is, and it's not that we go in and we decide, oh, well, this is what needs to be done. No, absolutely not. We need to listen, and then if we get invited, we need to humbly listen and take direction. It's super not what white people are used to doing. Mm-hmm. And even well-meaning white people aren't necessarily good at doing those things.
Yeah. Very true.
Have you guys, have there been times in your life where you thought that you were being helpful and then you found out you weren't?
Can I speak to what she just said?
Absolutely.
So I do want to speak to the fact that no one's been convicted of a crime. No one's been charged of a hate crime. That does not say that we don't have implicit racism in our area, in our region. We absolutely do. We absolutely need to have these conversations. But I want to be real clear that I was at the ceremony that they had for Josiah. It was very sad listening mm-hmm. to his mom and his friends grieve him. What a tragic thing. But as I said before, we've got to let the justice, we've got to let the law figure out what's going to happen with that before we crucify somebody mm-hmm. In the press or anywhere else. I just want to be very clear about that.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. I just think we have to note that in the systems in which we live, there are patterns where people suffer consequences and others who don't, and hopefully that mm-hmm. won't be the case in our community. Mm-hmm. But I understand people's skepticism and doubt around that in our community, like any other place.
You know, that reminds me of just recently I was at a training around social justice and racial issues. And one of our trainers, Date, awesome guy, he was giving a story about how PICO kind of changed where they were going, because for the longest time it was a very multitudes of different issues that were going on in communities. We still do that, but after the Ferguson issues, he was kind of called upon, like, hey, you know, this is your state, come stand up, you know, and he'd been working in social justice for a very long time. And he even found himself sitting there and doing what we have the habit of doing, which is, was this guy worthy? Is this guy worthy of me standing up and making a scene? And that was very eye-opening to him. And I think that that's one of the main things that I try to do, is just to always remember that everybody is a human, so he is worthy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even as enlightened as anybody can be, we still have these biases that stop us from honoring a person in the way that they should be.
Well, going back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, I think the question that I will want to ask, and maybe one of our listeners wants to weigh in on this, is we want due process for all of the parties involved with this tragedy in our community. How do we let our expressing our desire for due process to be served coexist with the very real feelings that people are having about this, without making people who feel or perceive this as a racially motivated crime feel like they're being shut down or silenced? Because I think that's very valid.
And I think that's just the goal of having these conversations that are not comfortable. And just, as Meredith said, be open and willing to listen. Even if you don't see it, doesn't mean it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it also doesn't mean to come out with your pitchforks either. So,
right.
You know, it is a fine line. And right now, like, especially like within True North, I've been with them for about 3 years. And what we're doing right now in society is we are creating a new language, and it's really hard to communicate right now. So we have to be patient with each other.
Related to the idea of language, first, that marginalized communities have been having these conversations for so long, mm-hmm. Since the beginning. And there is some criticism. There is talk about, well, who, related to True North designing a new language to communicate. I think a lot of times the idea is, well, who's coming up with the lingo? Like, well, did white people make up microaggressions? Or did white people make up the word diversity? Or did white people make up the word equity or mm-hmm. racial equity instead of just maybe hatred or bigotry? Like, and I think the idea is that, yes, we would like white people to participate, but there's also this idea of white fragility, so there's some tiptoeing with language. Mm-hmm. And so it's really problematic because I was recently facilitating a workshop with someone who said, like, a woman of color who said she identifies as Latina, she said, I didn't know microaggressions was a word. Like, these things have been happening to me all around, you know, but, oh, she's like, I'd kind of call that hate, mm-hmm. you know, so I think I think especially with white people in the conversation, we have to, and wanting to participate, we have to acknowledge that, like, we're going to mess up, mm-hmm. we're not going to do it right. It's problematic because we're the people in the power structure, with more privilege and power. So our participation is problematic. We take that with us everywhere.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so I just want to take a quick break and let our listeners know you can call in at 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. We're talking about being good allies to people of color. And we're very lucky tonight to have on the line Dr. Paul Cavell. He's the author of Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Social Justice. Dr. Cavell, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure to be with you. I'm not a doctor.
Oh, my mistake.
I'm just a regular guy.
Tell us a little bit about your work.
Well, I've been working pretty much all of my adult life, which is lengthy at this point, has been working, doing education activism and writing about issues of social justice, particularly race, gender, class, those kinds of things, and also working a lot on violence prevention with young people and adults. And I'm one of the people who helped put together SURGE, Showing Up for Racial Justice, back in 2009. And I'm also very involved with our local chapter here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Excellent. And can you tell us a little bit about the inspiration for SURGE, how it came about?
Well, it was particularly a response to a call from people of color that were requesting that white people step up, because after Obama got elected, there was a lot of kind of increasing hate directed towards Obama and his wife, and also there was an increase in militia movements and organizing, right-wing organizing, and people of color came to some of us who were white and said, you know, we're doing what we can, but we need strong white voices out there responding and, you know, working in the addressing the white community. So we put together a project, an organization, and committed to basically educating and mobilizing white people to work for racial justice in a multiracial alliance with people of color-led movements. Mm-hmm.
What does that look like on a practical level? What does that look like on the ground?
Well, it looks a lot of different ways, because we have over 200 chapters around the country, and they're in lots of different locations, some in big cities, some in small towns, some in rural areas, and different parts of the country. So it means, on the one hand, doing direct work with white people to do education about issues of racism and inequality, and to give them the skills and preparation to be able to show up effectively. And it means direct solidarity work with people of color-led organizations, whoever those might be in particular communities. They might be Black Lives Matter, they might be indigenous struggles, they might be immigrant rights struggles. You know, there's just so many different local conditions. So it means building accountability relationships with those groups and responding to their needs for resources, for people to show up, for fundraising, for all kinds of different possible things with as many white people as possible.
And how has the structure, or I'm sorry, not the structure, how have things changed since the election of Donald Trump and this general conversation we're having about race and racism in our country?
Well, I think that, you know, SURGE has been growing consistently because there's been just so much visible documentation of the violence against African Americans by the police, and brutality and racial harassment, and you know, increasing anti-immigrant rhetoric, and of course people wanting to show up in support for Standing Rock and the indigenous struggles for sovereignty and land and environmental justice. So what happened after the election is that that accelerated, and a lot of chapters that were, you know, working, doing the work, but were fairly small, all of a sudden were faced with issues of absorbing a lot of white people who were increasingly shocked and upset and afraid and wanting to do something about the new administration. The new administration is not new in the sense that the basic politics behind it are very deeply rooted in our country, and getting rid of the new administration won't solve those problems, but it's a heightened visibility and a moment when a lot of white people are saying, now I do have to do something. I can no longer avoid or excuse or procrastinate. I do have to be out helping respond to this now.
Sorry, I wanted to open it up to my guests. So I'm monopolizing you.
Agreed.
So one of the things that you mentioned, I'm looking at your guidelines for being strong white allies. One of the things on here is a suggestion. It says your body on the line when it says what people of color want from white allies. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure. There's a tremendous number of ways that as white people we can leverage our resources for racial justice. And that has to do with time and skills and connections and money and things like that. But one of the important ways is people of color, just whether it's in local communities or nationally, are organizing marches and vigils and protests, and they're, you know, testifying to city council meetings, and they're working in electoral processes, and they need more white people to show up in person, embodied, in those kinds of situations. So that could mean a range of kinds of activities, but it means not just pushing a button on your computer to sign a petition or writing a check, but actually making a commitment to being physically present in
Absolutely.
Places where it really makes a difference.
Absolutely, I agree.
Uh-huh.
I think that, as a general rule, Humboldt folks are pretty good at showing up for protest.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. But I think one of the other things that I'd really like to discuss tonight is what we do on a day-to-day basis. You know, do we do the right thing when no one's watching? What does that look like?
Well, when you say when no one's watching, what do you mean? Because we're in public a lot. So people are watching. We may pretend that we're not involved or it's not affecting us, but, you know, if a person of color is stopped by the local authorities and we're driving by or walking down the street, no one may be noticing us, but we're there and we have a role to play. And our families at home, our children are watching us, our friends and family are watching us. So we're constantly in positions where we can take small and large steps to, you know, address issues of racial justice, to bring up the subject, to intervene in situations that where people make comments or behave in ways that are discriminatory. We shop in stores where might be connected to a school or a club or all kinds of different ways that our daily lives are interwoven in a community in which racism is ongoing and pervasive. So I think that it's partly taking that racial lens into our daily lives, so that we're constantly asking the question, how is racism showing up here? what's going on, and if there's and if we think that it's all white, so therefore there's no racism, then the first question to ask is, why is it all white in the first place? What are the barriers that are keeping people of color from participating?
So I guess, you know, I'll speak to that. I'm pretty involved in our community, and I'm out there a lot. And I really feel like being present for people is really important. Being willing to step out of your comfort zone and look somebody in the eyeballs and treat them like a human being, regardless. And I do believe, too, that it has to do, it starts with our kids. We have got to get our kids educated. This is something that's been going on for years, and I think we're doing a good job. A lot of people are doing a good job in educating our youth. This is not okay at all. And I think, you know, it's going to be a process to shift it, but the more people that are involved, one person at a time, we can change this. And I know that, you know, you've been working on it a long time, and that's frustrating, but that doesn't mean it's time to give up and quit treating people with respect and dignity and quit showing up for people. I think showing up, just knowing that people care, makes a huge impact and a huge change in people's lives.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's always opportunities to start that discussion or to notice out loud what's going on or to build a relationship with the people around you so that you can bring up issues of race, class, and gender, and whatever else is there. I think it's really the important part. I mean, our children are learning racism all the time from the society around them, from friends and family and school and textbooks and the media and cartoons, everything. So unless we're actively helping them look at that and understand that and navigate that, then by the time we get around as adults comfortable enough with them to bring it up, they've already had years of conditioning into, you know, racism.
And Meredith.
Oh, to add to that, there's an article that came out recently. I hope it's posted on our Search Humble page. If not, it will be by tonight. there's an article that just came out about kids who are four or five who already are seeing through a lens of racism. That it's already, it is already there. Okay, cool. But so that parents have a huge role to play, obviously, in talking about race and talking about being white, like if it's a white family, like talking about being white, like talking about in child appropriate ways or age appropriate ways, like things that are happening and things that are going on. And even as a white person having a misstep or like, oh, I just had an experience of like traveling while white, that's my privilege, like that I talk it out with my kids so he and hopefully sees me trying to repair or do. But yeah.
Well, right, and they can be woven in pretty seamlessly into our daily lives with our kids because, you know, we're reading stories with them and we're watching movies and cartoons with them and we're walking down the street and shopping with them. And so, you know, they are observing a lot of things, and if we are not pointing them out and noticing them and helping them ask questions about, you know, it's not so much about telling them things as asking them, you know, what do you see going on here, and how do you think, what's the impact of that, and how does it feel when you see that, and what's the impact on that person?
And I think the responsibility lies on the parents to model good behavior, and, you know, I think education through schools and education through conversation has to happen. It just has to. You know, when I grew up here in Eureka, when I grew up, I went to a homogeneous Washington elementary. There were no black people. There were no anybody of color. And so I remember when the first African-American student came and how it was like, whoa, what is going on here? And then we had some friends that moved here from Mexico that were adopted. And then they came to the school and it was like, oh my gosh, this big hubbub. Like, there was so much fear is what I want to say. There was so much fear of the parents and the kids involved. And gratefully, we've all become really good friends over the years. But fear drives a lot of this. And we've got to get to that root cause.
I agree. And I'm just going to hang on just a sec, guys. We do have a call on the line from Karpani. Do I have that right? In Arcata?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, I was calling because I was wondering, how do we include the people of color in the conversation for white people so that we can listen and that we can move forward? Because I think that we can't rely on what we think we know. Mm-hmm. We have to listen to what we need to learn from people of color. And so that's my question.
Invite them.
Yeah, I think that what you're raising is really important, and it's a question of building relationships and inviting them, asking them what they need, what their experiences are. But we also, people of color are, there's a lot out there that they've said and written and produced about their experience and what they need. And so we want to make sure we're not just requiring them to do all the work as well. We need to balance that so that we are reading what they write and watching the movies and listening to the music and really, doing our homework as well as being in relationship with people of color and inviting them into the conversation. And particularly if there's organizations that are led by people of color, building relationships with those organizations so we can be directly supporting the work that they're doing.
Building relationships is huge.
Also, just I think that if we have relationships with people of color who are willing to answer our questions or direct us, that we're really fortunate that it isn't any person's job to teach us. I mean, I think it's tricky because on one hand we want guidance so we're being helpful, and on the other hand, like, it isn't a person of color's job to educate me. Like Paul's saying, if you look online, there are like Google documents about decolonizing, and there are tons of books out there if you're looking for anti-racist information. There are things particular to schools if you're an educator. You could look up Surge Families if you're interested, if you're a parent. I'm not sure what you're looking for, but there are definitely books out there and films like the show on Netflix, Dear White People, that's a good place to start. The movie Get Out, W. Kamau Bell, Anywhere, Anytime, Anyhow, his book came out today. So there definitely are places.
Awesome.
Yes.
Well, the interesting part for me is that in the 60s, I married a black man. I have two interracial children who are beautiful and successful, and yet I feel like I'm starting fresh. I'm in a community that does not welcome people of color, and I'm finding myself not knowing really what to do. You know, I mean, because I have my relationship with people of color. But it's like, yeah, so.
It's very hard. I know that I was raised here, and I know one of the hardest things is that you can literally spend a whole day in many places of Humboldt and actually never have a chance to even see someone of color.
Right.
And so that makes it very difficult to organically grow some of those relationships. So definitely getting involved in some of the different groups that are multicultural, multiracial, like True North is, we are all of the above.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, things like that are, it really does help with opening that, because especially here, people can silo themselves very, very easily. When we were talking earlier about integration of like the school fact, like when I was a kid, we had one colored child and he was adopted from like Nicaragua. And it's not that way anymore. But I had left here for about 7 years ago, and this was about 7 years since then. When I came back with my three children, and I happened to have the privilege and the opportunity to choose what kind of school I wanted to put my kids in.
Right.
And what I did, not thinking, you know, because I don't have to think, that's where my privilege is. I don't have to think about who's going to be in the school.
Exactly.
And so I looked online and went, ooh, look at all these great scores the school has. And so I had put them in there. One of my children was having a real difficult time there, and so I had to, he had to leave. Let's just say, put it that way. And so I ended up putting him into another school, which is, and what got me is, you know, I've been doing this work for 3 years, and I hadn't realized that I had been isolating my own children until I had put them into this other school, which is like the most, racially diverse school in elementary schools in Eureka. And my son, who goes on all these things with me, protests, he sees my, you know, he's with me all the time. He walks out of his first day and he goes, man, Mom, there's a lot of brown kids here. And I was like, oh no, what am I doing? I am not doing what I am saying. So, next year, all my kids went to that school, and that's where they are now. And actually, it is so much more comfortable there, maybe because I fit better, I feel better there. I don't know, but it was one of those moments of, you know, oh my gosh, what am I doing? So, you know, and this is a way to change those situations. And it's still a privilege, because I have a privilege to put them there, and I could have the privilege of putting them somewhere else, but... every little step, I think, is worth it, and relationships are the biggest key.
Absolutely. So, company.
And I think the beauty of the whole challenge is that yes, we have privilege, mm-hmm. and so we have a leg up.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm going to have to let you go, company, because we have another caller on the line. But thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Come to Surge on the second Sunday at 2.
Or there's True North next Thursday.
And NAACP.
NAACP.
Or you can join all of them.
They do great work.
Yes.
And then, Paul, are you still on the line there?
Yes, I am.
Took a long call there. So I just wanted to throw something out at you guys that I thought was really important that was brought up. And that is, like, when I was planning this show, one of the things that I really wanted to avoid is the trope of, like, how everyone has, like, their one black friend, you know, that they use to underwrite all of their opinions mm-hmm. on race, you know? I really didn't want to invite one person of color onto the show or two people of color onto the show and expect them to do all the heavy lifting when it comes to this topic. And we were talking earlier about the term microaggressions, and that's one of the things that I hear referred to as a microaggression. You know, if you have conversations you want to have around this topic, you always refer to, you know, people of color to do the work for you. And that's something that you also wrote in your guidelines, which is don't ask me to speak for my people.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Well, okay. It definitely comes back to what we were talking about earlier about having to do our work and not expecting people of color to either represent their race or just to educate us or to do the emotional work or the practical work of taking care of situations that are racist or discriminatory. It comes back to practicing being an ally every day by intervening and interrupting and doing the homework and not turning to the one person of color around us and saying, what do you think about this? As if they could reflect the voice of, you know, millions of other people of color.
Excellent. And Paul, we've kept you on the line longer than I'd promised you. I said 15 minutes, and you've very graciously been with us for, I think, 25 now. So thank you so much
for your
time tonight.
Sure. You. And I just, we've talked about several different things, but I just want to emphasize that we're all on indigenous land, and we all have native communities around us as well. And sometimes they're less visible than other communities of color, but it's no less important to be building bridges with those communities and supporting their efforts to around land and sovereignty and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever else that they're concerned about. So just want to bring that to attention before I sign off.
Thank you, Paul.
Surge has a great website with lots of resources. It's showingupforracialjustice.org. And there's lots of ways to get involved. Just encourage everybody to think about, you know, what's your next step? How can you get more involved in addressing the social justice issues in our communities? Because now is the time, as we can see and feel all around us, now is the time to really show up for racial justice.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being
Paul.
With us.
Thank you. And I just want to remind our listeners that you can call in at 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. Tonight we're talking about being good white allies and showing up for racial justice. And we do have a call on the line. It's Maureen from Arcata. Hi, Maureen.
Hi.
How's it going?
I'm a little irritated, actually, listening to this because... You know, the question was asked about what can we do as white people, I guess, to reach out more to people of color. And your answer was invite them.
Mm-hmm.
And what you said at the beginning of the show is that everyone there are white people. And I guess I don't understand why a person of color was not, quote, invited to mm-hmm. be a part of your panel.
Well, as I said a little earlier, and this is Linda, by the way, I'm the host of the show, and I'm taking responsibility for that because it's my decision. As I said a little earlier, I did feel that it was important to address our own privilege and our own role in racism as white people. And also, I was uneasy about the idea of inviting someone on and asking them to basically underwrite our opinions, or I didn't want to tokenize someone and make them responsible for the opinions of all people of color, because I feel like that comes up a lot in this discussion. But I am, of course, always open to criticisms from you or from my guests, so I do appreciate you asking about it.
Well, I appreciate your sensitivity there, with the exception, I guess, that, you know, when you invite a person of color to speak, it doesn't always have to mean that you're asking them to speak for every person of their color. I mean, you are asking that person based on their experience. And that, I think, is what it's all about. It's about recognizing the experience that people of color have that white people can't know because they don't have that experience.
I think tonight, to me, what brought me here was the fact that the racial conversations between white people do not happen. They don't go deep enough. And, like, I mean, still, we can spend a whole day not bumping into anybody of color. So our, you know, sometimes...
Well, I guess I have to wonder what people of color who are listening to this right now are thinking and feeling.
I would hope good that we're talking about this.
Meredith.
This is Meredith. And at the beginning, when I introduced myself, I said that there was some recent criticism of Surge that had us rethinking what we're doing and what our role is and what our accountability relationships look like. We hope down the line to develop relationships with NAACP, so we're attending. Okay. And we hope to develop relationships down the line with True North, so we've been attending. And we hope to develop relationships with Centro del Pueblo down the line, so we've been attending. But also, Centro del Pueblo, we have a connection there, and they graciously said, you know, thank you for coming, but your white presence at our meetings is turning out to be not so helpful. Mm. So we're asking that you help in these other ways. And we said, okay, we'll tell our people, like, please don't attend or take a break on attending, or a few of us, but not all, because of the space that we take up. And we can be helpful in these other ways that were specifically recommended by Renee, one of the leaders there.
This is a learning experience.
Mm-hmm. And, yes. Again, Maureen, sorry to interrupt you. Just, responding to that question, I have to say that a lot of times I do worry about getting this conversation wrong. And I think that a lot of people worry about doing this conversation wrong. And I think that people worrying about doing this conversation wrong sometimes prevents them from having the conversation in the first place, which is the last thing I want. So,
agreed.
Sorry.
No, I agree. I think that that's totally true. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to speak to that. I think that oftentimes we're so afraid of hurting other people's feelings or not doing the right thing that we're not willing to have these really hard talks. It's okay to make a mistake. It's okay to make an amends. It's okay to learn from other people. And so, if we're making a mistake right now, that's great. We can figure out how to do it better in the future, and we can figure out how to make better connections in the future because we're willing to give it a shot. That's my take on it.
Meredith.
To add to that, the article that was published in the beginning of April that criticizes Surge is called Whites Only, Surge and the Caucasian Invasion of Racial Justice Spaces. And the woman who wrote it is Didi Delgado, and she's involved with Black Lives Matter Cambridge and also works with the Unitarian Universalist community there. But one of her criticisms and concerns about Surge is that given the structures and institutions in which we navigate that already favor white folks, her concern is, why are we now creating another space that's mostly just for white folks? So white folks can have comfortable conversations about race, which might be something to consider in this context. Like, I didn't know who would be here, right? But we are all white women, right? So,
I understand that you're all well-meaning and good people, and I don't mean that in a condescending way at all. I truly believe that your hearts are in the right place. But when you say invite, quote, them, then you need to walk the talk, I think. You need to invite people of color to be part of the conversation so that when everybody's sitting around talking, someone can bring in a perspective that is different than, well, in this case, the majority, the entirety of who is there.
So I appreciate you bringing that, Maureen, bringing that forward. I'm Kim. And I do want to say that I do and am out in the community every day walking my talk with people. And I think it's really important that, I mean, we're having a conversation here, but that's not where it begins. You know, we have to, each individual has to take responsibility to be a part of the solution in this. Everybody. This isn't a one person or a four person or even a one regulatory one group of people, whether that be the NAACP, True North, you know, any of those things. It takes all of us to be a part of this, and we're going to fall down, we're going to make mistakes, and that's okay. At least if we're moving forward, we're going to be working in a good direction. So I appreciate you bringing that forward. I think that's really an important thing to say, and I would like to encourage you too to get involved and to get involved with NAACP, True North, some of these groups that actually are having these conversations all the time. And if you can't, get involved just with your local walking down the street community.
All right, thank you. We do have another call on the line from Sandra. Maureen, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to take Sandra's call now. Sandra?
Thank you.
Oh, yes, I'm a senior citizen here in Arcata, and I just like to, a very short story about my mother. I was 10 about 1950. I'm not sure about if that was the exact year. Something happened, which I don't remember, but she took out a piece of white paper, put it down on the desk. I remember it was the desk. Put my arm on it and said, "What color are you?" And against the white paper, I was brown. And I would just like to let everyone else out there know there are no white people out there. We are all brown. brown, and I've grown up with that, and I have a hard time and sometimes talking to brown people because we don't see things differently, we see things the same. But I hope people will go out there and put down the piece of white paper, look at their arms, and see what color they are. Thank you.
Thank you, Sandra. And that reminds me of something that W. Kamau Bell said when he came here, when he said race is a social construct, but racism is not. Yeah, racism is very real and alive.
Yeah, exactly right. It varies, but we're all the same.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for calling in. We have about 6 minutes left, so...
This Didi Delgado article quotes a woman who's a sex worker and an activist. Her name is Laura Lamoon, and she says, "Sex worker and activist Laura Lamoon put it best when she wrote, 'An ally should be personally gaining nothing through their activism. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you are an ally, you should be losing things through your activism. Mm-hmm. Space, voice, recognition, validation, identity, and ego.'" And I think the question, I think that's a great quote for us to
Absolutely.
Use and refer to again and again as we move along on this, in this conversation, and hope to get better at participating and involving other white people too, and talking more about race and privilege and systems and internalized racism, mm-hmm. interpersonal.
Thank you. And this is something that I wanted to talk about, was I think that once we become aware of our privilege, the next conversation we need to have is, how do we use that privilege to lift other people up? And I'm wondering how you guys do that in your own lives. Like, maybe lift other people up is the wrong way to put it. How do you exercise that privilege in service of other people?
I'm a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So I teach language. What's coming up? Cinco de Mayo is coming up. This is an example, right? Mm-hmm. What's Cinco de Mayo? Cinco de Mayo's not Cinco de Drinko, right? And there are news programs that say it's the great time to have the sombrero as your centerpiece. No, right? What is Cinco de Mayo? What is it based upon? What is the history, right? A battle in Puebla, a small underdog group of Mexicanos beat the French army. Mm-hmm. Okay, that people in Mexico don't really celebrate too much, except for maybe in Puebla, mm-hmm. but in the U.S., you know, it's this whole other commercialized thing. That's an example. Just trying to be aware of being white in teaching, it affects everything. And most teachers are white, mm-hmm. and we have increasingly more diverse groups of students, and so we really have to pay attention. So talking to other teachers about who we are in the class, we bring it with us, whatever it is. So that's an example.
That's great. Carpania's called back really quickly. You had a quick question?
I just want to say thank you, for your courage to bring this messy, messy conversation to the airwaves. I love you all. It's beautiful.
You.
And, you know, and it's inspiring, and wow, it's happening. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
I appreciate it. And we were talking about using our own privilege. Aaron, Kim, what about you guys?
I can no longer, this is so funny, the other morning, Sunday morning, usually my husband used to love Sunday mornings with me. We have 5 children. Okay, but this is the morning that we can have our cup of coffee with the door shut for a little bit longer, because they'll get on their tablets or cartoons. And he gets up, and, you know, sometimes I frustrate him, and he gets up and he goes, you know, I'm done with these Sunday mornings. And I'm like, why? He goes, because it's like a history lesson every day. I can no longer have, I don't want to say shallow conversations because that's belittling, but I can't help but go deep in just about every situation I am in. And I think that, you know, I don't work right now. I get to have the privilege of being a stay-at-home mom. So my work, technical work, is not there. So I spend a lot of time. I'm a professional volunteer at this point. So, but my conversations will go deep no matter what. So that's right now what I get to do. And, of course, the work with True North and all the other groups that I have been involved in the years. So.
Excellent. We have about 2 minutes left.
You are indeed a volunteer extraordinaire.
I know.
So I also work with youth, and I try to model and educate kids. At our home, we Martin Luther King, his birthdays are like high holiday at home, and we do a lot of civil rights discussion, and we do that at our school. We do Peacemaker of the Month at my old school where I worked. And personally, I think, you know, it's really important to stand up and be available for people. And that's what I do that pretty regularly, like probably every day, all the time. I try and be available for people to have that conversation, to talk things out, because I think that those relationships and building relationships, I mean, you know, white, black, people, conversations, talking about what is going on and what can we do to create solutions for each other. And, you know, and what can I do as, you know, as a person, as a white person, to move things forward? You know, I grew up with black people. It's never been an issue for me. And I'm really grateful for that.
Mm-hmm.
But all around me, I remember I was in college and a family member, I'm not going to say which one, I was going to go dancing with this black guy. And they told me, if you go out with this person, you're not allowed back in the house. And so, you know, I realized just how ugly it is. It's horrific. But I think one person at a time, we can impact change, but we have to be willing to talk about it. We have to be willing to move forward. And, you know, from what I'm hearing tonight, there's a lot of people involved, and I'm really grateful for that. And if you're looking for a way to get involved, you don't need to start your own thing. I mean, there's lots of ways to get involved. There's NAACP, there's True North, there's Surge, there's a lot of opportunity. Even a baseball team. Get involved in your community, and you're going to learn about this stuff.
Excellent.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Aaron Powers Taylor. Thank you, Meredith Oram.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you guys being here. My name is Linda Stansberry. I've been your host. And I just want to remind our listeners that if you want to have this conversation, make it messy and follow the example of our caller Maureen, and don't be afraid to call people on their BS if you think that they're full of BS. Like, yeah. I think that's really important.
So important.
If you see something, say something, stand up for other people, and stand up to people in your own race and your own class when you feel like they're not being helpful, when they're not being good allies, or when they're being downright racist.
Yeah. Thank you, Linda.
Yeah, thank you to all of our listeners. And that has been Thursday Night Talk. And thank you also to Michael Roccaforte, our engineer extraordinaire.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Linda Stansberry, to our guests, and to our many callers this evening. We'd love to get feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Eric Kirk is our host next week. Thanks to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next. It's 8 o'clock.
Tune in to the KHSU Magazine, KHSU's midday public affairs program. Join hosts Claire Reynolds, Brian Curtis, Katie Whiteside, Lorna Bryant, and Danielle Orr. Connect with your community Monday through Friday from 1 to 1:30, right here on KHSU.
Donors to KHSU include Six Rivers Optical, offering a large selection of eyewear, sunglasses, and contact lenses. Same-day service is available for prescriptions in stock.